Hello, my name is Dave Emery, and this is Sod 2 of For the Record program number 644, interview with Ed Haslam about Dr. Mary's Monkey. This program is being recorded on August 10th of the year 2008. Once again, it is my pleasure and privilege to bring back to our airwaves Ed Haslam, the author of the aforementioned Dr. Mary's Monkey, published by Trine Day. Ed, welcome back to our airwaves.
Thank you, Dave.
Alrighty, we have been talking about the city of New Orleans. We've been talking about Dr. Alton Ochsner, New Orleans' importance in economics, politics, geography, and we've been talking about tropical diseases, monkey viruses, and a cancer epidemic that appears to have been caused by that. And we've been talking about an interesting cast of characters, Bernice Eddy, Dr. Sarah Stewart, and Dr. Mary Sherman, about whom we'll say much more in Sod 2. Let's show people how this medical milieu, so to speak, fits into and overlaps a really insidious covert action milieu, which in turn was part of the circumstantial environment that in which the JFK assassination occurred. Why don't we start with David Ferry and who he was, and how a person like David Ferry comes to intersect with medical heavyweights like Sarah Stewart, Bernice Eddy, and above all, Dr. Mary Sherman.
Well, that was one of the questions that drove my initial inquiry into this, because it was Jim Garrison who had made the claim that he had associated David Ferry with Dr. Mary Sherman, and he didn't pretend to know what the nature of their association was, but the fact that Ferry was not credentialed in medical stuff, everybody knew he was very bright and very well read, but he was basically a defrocked priest, and who had become an airline pilot and lost his airline pilot. He was a big jet pilot for Eastern, and had lost that job due to his a homosexual incident involving a teenage boy, and all that. He was on the low end of the totem pole socially and. Not educationally, but credentials-wise. And Mary Sherman, on the other hand, was chairman of the pathology committee of the American Academy of Orthopedic Surgeons, a professor at Tulane Medical School, head of the bone pathology laboratory at Ochsner Clinic, which was a world-renowned organization. She had impeccable credentials. She came from the University of Chicago. And so this whole question of what are these two people doing together was a burning, mind-boggling question, and frankly drove the entire first book of Mary Ferry and the Monkey Virus. In fact, that's the title. She's the Mary. Mary Ferry and the Monkey Virus. How do you explain this? How do you explain this triangulation here between these three people? And the answer that came to me after the first book was out, and one day the phone rang, and it was 60 Minutes for the CBS News show, and they called to tell me they were investigating this woman who kept telling them that she was in this laboratory that I had written about in my book. And they actually brought me, they decided not to air her story for reasons of their own. But they were very interested in her, and in fact, I saw an internal correspondence where they said they spent more time and money on her story than they had on any story in the history of 60 Minutes. So they certainly took her seriously, and for whatever reason made the decision not to air her story. But they brought me Judith Ferry Baker, who is a very interesting person, because in the late 1950s, when she was still in high school, she was a science superstar, and had won some incredible, GE sponsors a great big science competition for high school students, and she had won that competition for some work that she was doing on pulling magnesium out of seawater, and she got very interested in researching cancer, and was getting money from the American Cancer Society and other organizations. She was actually, as a high school student producing cancer in mice faster than they were able to do it at the national laboratories. And that got a lot of attention on her and got her an introduction to Dr. Alton Ochsner, who, of course, had been president of the American Cancer Society. And he invited her, according to her testimony, to New Orleans to participate in a an activity which she was led to believe was a national security / intelligence operation. And she didn't know the real nature of it when she went there, but she was being asked to do something important by important people. And she gets there, and she gets introduced to David Ferry, and she's basically assigned a babysitter or bodyguard who's an ex-Marine who's from New Orleans and knows the people in the territory. And that's Lee Harvey Oswald, and they are both given cover jobs at the Riley Coffee Company. They start on the same day. They leave at approximately the same time, which is when Oswald is arrested for the leafleting. And Lee helps her find an apartment on the bus route that he takes to work, and so they ride the bus to work at the Riley Coffee Company each day. They go in and clock in, and then Lee sneaks out to go do all this work that he's doing with Guy Bannister and stuff, and she covers for him with his time cards and stuff. And then a couple of times a week, they go over to David Ferry's apartment where they are working on a project which is explicitly a biological weapon involving cancer-causing viruses, which they are developing for the purpose, the stated purpose, as it's explained to them, of killing Fidel Castro.
And let's halt here just a minute, and we'll backtrack for a second to Dr. Mary Sherman and how she died and the part of the linear particle accelerator, because that's quite remarkable. But I think we should probably take just a minute here and fill in some of the political background of this cast of characters. The head of Riley Coffee Company, Dr. Alton Ochsner, the aforementioned Guy Bannister, for whom the aforementioned David Ferry worked, and bear in mind that Mary Sherman worked with David Ferry, these were all extreme right-wingers involved with the covert action milieu in New Orleans that was part of the anti-Castro effort, and which also was part, at least to a certain extent, was part of the JFK assassination mechanism. Tell us a little bit about, again, Mrs. Riley, and we've already heard about Dr. Alton Ochsner, about how Riley and Guy Bannister and David Ferry fit into this extreme right-wing and covert action milieu.
Well, I think you've already said what can be said about it, you know, because there are things that I can't really say, and I don't think it would be appropriate to say, but Riley was, you know, a well-known anti-communist because he was in the coffee importing business, and anything that threatened to have the communists take over the countries that, where he was buying his coffee from, was not good news for him.
Mm-hmm.
And but did Riley himself know that Lee Oswald was working at his family's business or not? I don't know. It's difficult to prove. Or know that Oswald and Baker were involved in any of these other things. What we do know is that the vice president of Riley Coffee Company at the time was an ex-FBI agent by the name, to the extent that anyone is an ex-FBI agent, called Bill Moynihan, and who later winds up being the executive director for the Metropolitan Crime Commission in New Orleans, which is the organization that gives John Davis all the information about Carlos Marcello for his book Mafia Kingfish. And Moynihan testifies to the Warren Commission, you know, and he approved Oswald's hiring, but he doesn't bother to mention to the Warren Commission that on the same day he hired Lee Oswald, he also hired a secretary who was Judith Ferry Baker. I mean, he explicitly leaves her out of the conversation, and she's got her tax records and her pay stubs and letterheads from the company. I mean, she can prove she worked there.
And you reproduce a lot of that documentation in your book.
Right. And a thought on the book, per our conversations when we're off air, I want people to know that this book is not a boring research book about a bunch of technical stuff. It's got a 5-star reader rating on Amazon, and I encourage you to go read the reader comments on that to find out the reader reaction to the book, because basically they all run around with their hair on fire after reading it. And another good book that's also available on Amazon that also has a five-star reader rating is The Virus and the Vaccine that you mentioned, and they're both good in-depth looks at various aspects of this huge subject.
Parenthetically, if people are interested in some of the actual story of the SV40, the research involved with it, and a very good explanation, albeit a technical one, about how SV40 actually causes cancer at the cellular level, the book is The Virus and the Vaccine by Debbie Bookchin, last name B-O-O-K-C-H-I-N, and Jim Schumacher, S-C-H-U-M-A-C-H-E-R. Again, a remarkable book, a more technical book in nature vis-a-vis the scientific aspects than yours, Ed, because you go in a lot of the political and historical work. But if people are wondering, you know, how does a monkey virus cause cancer, and the scientific proof of that, that'll allay all doubts. Back to Mary Sherman, and how did she die, Ed, and how did that spur your forensic investigation?
Well, I did mention that she was a professor at Tulane Medical School, and so was my father, and they were both orthopedic surgeons, and they both taught orthopedic surgery in the same department. So my father was a pretty good friend of Mary Sherman's, and when she was murdered, it was big news, and I heard about it at home, as well as in the papers and stuff. And the problem was that it was obviously things being whispered about it, and part of the whispers were the cover story that they were trying to put out, which tried to make her murder look like some psychosexual act and stuff. But what happened was I was suspicious about this enough that I remembered it for 30 years, and my parents had told me that some of the detail about what really happened to her. And I was motivated enough to get my hands on the autopsy reports and the police reports, which had been safely locked up for almost 30 years, and then one day quietly released over the New Orleans Public Library, which is where I found them. And in those reports, it became very obvious that there was a real problem that they never told the press about. And the problem was that Mary Sherman's right arm and right rib cage were completely disintegrated by heat, so much so that you could look in and see the internal organs of her body. Now, immediately next to that amazingly hot heat source was unburned human hair. Now, so you're left with another one of these conundrum questions. How do you burn off an entire arm, bone and all, and burn off the bones of the rib cage without even burning the hair next to it, which hair is the easiest thing to burn on the body, and bones the hardest, technically don't even burn. So there's nothing in her apartment that could create that damage, and therefore when you realize that, and realize that was the only fact of the case they didn't bother to tell the press, then you realize that they're covering up the main fact of the case. I mean, that's like saying Nicole Simpson had a sore throat, you know, and didn't bother to explain that she had a throat slit, you know. I mean, it's the main forensic fact of the case. And so when I realized that, you know, one of the questions I said, why didn't they tell the public this? Why didn't they tell the press this? Because they didn't want people running around New Orleans looking for a machine that might have burned off her arm. Which is the linear particle accelerator, because it was on U.S. government property in a top-secret operation, and they couldn't afford exposing that operation because people would say, well, why are you using radiation to roast monkey viruses? Because the answer is because we just mass-inoculated all your children with a cancer-causing virus. You know, that's the depth of this thing. I mean, that's where the real problem is. And so when you get into that, then you get into, how did her arm get burned off? Was this an accident, or was the accident accidental, or was somebody trying to shut her up, or was somebody trying to create an incident at this laboratory that would call in the press and blow the cover off the whole thing? I mean, you know, these are the questions I get into in the book, and it all traces back to this one woman who came from the University of Chicago and was an expert in cancer, who was involved in this, and Judith tells us that when she was invited to New Orleans, she was put under Mary's wing and would go from David Ferry's apartment over to Mary Sherman's apartment on a almost daily basis to drop off the product of their research so Mary could examine it and bring it back to the U.S. Public Health Service for some more radiation.
Before we get into more depth about Judith Very Baker, by the way, that's J-U-D-Y-T-H and Very is V-A-R-Y. For spelling purposes, and their work with Judith's work with Mary Sherman and David Ferry, and also Lee Harvey Oswald, in talking about the tremendous damage done to the cadaver of, well, at that time, the living body of Dr. Mary Sherman, the linear particle accelerator. Ed, could you tell us briefly? I know this is a complicated subject. Briefly, what that is, and what Dr. Mary Sherman was doing with such a device and how that would have produced that. Then let's go to the topic of Judith Very, David Ferry, Mary Sherman, and what they were working on down there.
Well, you know, I have the way the book is organized, there's like a chapter on about each one of these people in each one of these situations, and I have a chapter on the linear particle accelerator, and we were lucky enough to find a comparable machines in other parts of the world that fit our description exactly of it. But basically, this is a device that produces a beam of radiation. I mean, not terribly dissimilar to the Star Wars concepts and things. It stimulates radioactive material, shoots a beam of radiation, and then it's controlled with millions of volts of electricity. The model in question was about a 5 million volt machine. And so they're great big machines. They're not like desktop computers. They have to be built into a building. And this particular one, the beam shot towards the ground and then hit this platinum pyramid where it was split into sub-beams, which went into identical containers so they could expose you know, like a group of either mice or a group of test tubes to the identical dosage to see what happened to it. And we were able to track down the guy that said he built the facility. I mean, put the linear particle accelerator into the facility. What he described matched the actual physical place that we eventually figured out where it was. And we found the drawings of it. So, you know, there's a chapter in the book explaining all the detail of this, but that's what they are. They're, you know, people are generally familiar with like a cyclotron, which is the big atom smasher. That accelerates particles in a circle. This does not go in a circle. It just goes in a straight line, basically. And that's why they call it a linear particle accelerator. And it's accelerating heavy radioactive particles.
And so Dr. Mary Sherman was apparently working with one of these, and there was an accident. You hypothesized that it was actually deliberately sabotaged, and that's what burned off a nice chunk of her body.
Yes, I do personally believe it was an act of sabotage, and it burned off her right arm and rib cage, but it did not cross her heart. And whether it was the beam itself or whether it was the mass of electricity from the machine, which was somehow booby-trapped to, which I think to be the more likely case, came back. She was standing in front of a metal wall that they had put in to protect the operators from the radiation, and the metal wall was grounded, and the electricity jumped from whatever she was grabbing with her right hand and blew out the back of her body into this metal wall, which is why the usually in those heavy electrocutions, the electricity goes down the body into the ground and blows off the feet. And there was no problem with her feet. It had all gone out the back wall, and which would positively identify the place, by the way. And so that's what happened, but it did not cross her heart. And a lot of times in these big electrical things, the person can survive at least for a while because the heart keeps beating independently because the heart didn't get in the path of the electricity. And so what happens with Mary Sherman is after her arm is blown off, somebody decides to terminate her. And they stab her very carefully and very precisely in her heart to put her out of her misery. And once she is dead, then they put her in a body bag and they bring her back to her apartment. And they fake this murder scene where they stab her at that point with a number of times. And we know it's a different time because those wounds don't bleed. And then they set her on fire. And the reason for the fire is to create an explanation, however tenuous, for the burns on her body. But what happens is that the fire is so feeble that people see smoke, but nobody even reports seeing a flame, and it's in a wood-frame building, and the building doesn't catch on fire, and there's curtains next to her bed, and the curtains don't catch on fire. And so this little smoky mattress fire in her apartment was certainly not capable of burning off her arm, and that's the whole problem with her murder and why they had to cover it up so much. And when you realize that she was also involved in these political things, and you have to wonder, what is really the motive behind killing her? Was it to shut her up because the Warren Commission was starting to investigate in New Orleans that day? Or was the thing booby-trapped so the Warren Commission's attention would be called to her and the whole situation, so they'd find out what was going on in New Orleans? I mean, you know, these are questions I ask, and nobody's got any real simple answers to them, but I think they're worth thinking through, because, I mean, my big motive on this thing is you haven't even thought about this subject yet, because you don't even know the pieces and the players, and the Oliver Stone movie just gets you warmed up for it, but the depth of this thing is... It goes so far that if you really want to know what happened in the United States in the second half of the 20th century, this book will really change your thinking about it.
Yes, indeed. Now, linear particle accelerator was being used, as you point out, in all probability, to mutate viruses. We've got about 7 minutes left, and then I'd like you to promote your website and the book and so forth for listener purposes. Granted the fact that we are attempting to do something that's really impossible, which is to set forth a very important yet very complex hypothesis, people should perhaps think of us as kind of like a wishbone tee quarterback. We're handing it off, and you, the listeners, are the running backs. And the idea is to get the book, read it, and assimilate this, and then you'll be able to put these pieces of the puzzle together. Let's put the linear accelerator with the mutating of the viruses, Mary Sherman, Judith Vary Baker, David Ferry, and Lee Oswald. And how do those pieces fit together, and ultimately, how did Baker relate to Oswald, and what happened?
Well, those are a lot of questions for one question. Let me start off with saying the initial strategy, the initial reason for exposing the monkey viruses to the radiation was to create a weakened or benign form of the virus that could be used in a vaccine, similar to the strategy that had been used in the initial Salk vaccine, and where they had killed the virus and then put it into the body, and the body would find a dead virus but still know that it didn't belong there, and you get an immune response and all that stuff. So they're looking for something like this. But you know, when you start exposing viruses to radiation, it's a very dangerous game, okay? And you can make those viruses more deadly and more aggressive. You can even create things that the world has never seen before by doing it, because what you're doing is you're messing with the DNA. And so what they were discovering was that some of these things got very aggressive. I mean, some of the cancer-causing viruses were producing cancer faster than anybody had ever seen before. And that is the event that changes the mission of this thing, is Castro gets, Cuba gets Russian nuclear missiles pointed at the United States, okay? The idea of, in New Orleans is one of the main targets, okay? And the people in New Orleans are very intimidated by this and very angry about it, and they want to get rid of Castro. So the problem is, the White House, the Kennedys, have agreed not to get Castro publicly. So how do you get Castro? I mean, you can't just go over and bomb his place, because then it's pretty clear who did it. They're looking for a black op stealth way of getting rid of Castro. And so they said, well, why don't we take these aggressive cancer things and maybe we can get it in there, and some docs on our side in Cuba and everything else. And I think it's a harebrained scheme myself, but it's very clearly what they said they were trying to do. And that was the explanation that was given to Judith Vere Baker. What I'm concerned about, I mean, frankly, is that may just have been what they told her to get her to do the work. The real people behind this, we don't know who the real people behind this are, and they may have had a completely different objective. They may have been trying to figure out how to get rid of this promiscuous and unproductive lower class all over the world. You know, I mean, that may have been their mission, because they saw things like integration as the manifestation of communism in America. You know, these are very right-wing people in this group, and I'm not going to mention any particular names in there, but I promise you that that type of thinking was going on in New Orleans at the time. And so, you know, the best thing we have is the explanation given to Judith that said they're trying to kill Fidel Castro, and the logical, and that makes some kind of sense in response to the Russian missiles. But we, since there has not been a real investigation into this thing, I mean, my book is kind of a case for an investigation. I'm one man in a word processor, and I don't have a staff and a budget and a subpoena power. So there's only so much I can put together on it, but I can certainly ask the questions. And what looks like is going on here is they're taking this juiced up virus that's been exposed to radiation, discovering which ones are creating cancer the fastest and getting the biggest tumors. They're taking those tumors, grinding them up, and sending them back to the laboratory for more radiation. And then they're injecting them into new rats again, new mice, and waiting for the tumors to grow. And they've got this whole operation set up in several buildings in New Orleans, and like the where they're raising the mice with the 2,000 cages, that's not in David Ferry's apartment. It's in an apartment across the street from it that I stumbled into one day. And so they would select the mice that are ready to be harvested, if you will, the tumors harvested, kill them, put them in a box, bring them over to David Ferry's place where Judith Vere Baker would cut them apart, cut out the tumors, throw it in a blender, create the sauce that needed to be sent back for more radiation, put it in test tubes and stuff, clean up the place to laboratory standards, and then transport it with Lee at her side over to Mary Sherman's apartment, which was conveniently located on the bus route on the way home back to her apartment. So, you know, it's when you lay this out on a map and say, all right, here's the loop and here are the people and this is what's happening, it all makes a fair degree of sense. And, you know, what we did in the book, and Try and Day did a great job of this, because they really backed me up with better maps and illustrations and stuff than I had done in the first book. And it really makes the story come to life, because you can see the pieces and the players and everything in action.
Give us your website, Ed, because we're just about out of time. We've got about 10 seconds left.
Dr. Mary's Monkey, spell out Dr., D-O-C-T-O-R, Mary's with an S, Monkey, M-O-N-K-E-Y.com.
And if people are wondering how the pieces of the puzzle fit together, if people are confused, if people are scared, if people are curious, get the book, and I think that you will understand. You will certainly understand a whole lot more than you do now. This concludes Side 2 of For the Record program number 644, interview with Ed Haslam about Dr. Mary's Monkey. This has been recorded on August 10th of the year 2008. For Ed Haslam, this is Dave Emery saying thanks for listening.